Hey, you there, you automotive enthusiast with your finger on the play button. It happened again. You push play on another episode of the...
The eudaimonic episode of V8 Radio, Kevin.
Eudaimonic?
That is right. That is right. And eudaimonic, Kevin, in case you're wondering,
means not at all.
Conducive to happiness.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
I have shorts that are eudaimonic, I think.
Right on. I think I do, too.
Yeah, right on. Well, you are listening to the eudaimonic V8 Radio podcast. I'm Kevin Ostey, joined, as always, by our esteemed co-host, Mr. Mike Hubal-Clark. And this is a podcast that hangs out in the automotive arena and other places sometimes. And we like to kick off every episode with a special event. You think? I think it's special.
Is it a special event?
I think so.
All right.
It's to everybody else, it's a trivia question, but to us, it's a special event.
It's content. It's show prep.
You know, it's thought-provoking.
Amen.
It's eudaimonic. Is that what it was?
It eudaimonic. Is. Conducive to happiness. It makes us happy.
There you go. So we trade questions in the beginning of the show, and at the end, the answers are revealed, and the world's a better place for it. So, Mr. Cueball, have you prepared a trivia question for this episode?
Indeed I have, good sir. And away we go. So, Kevin, either last episode or the one before that, we mentioned the Isle of Man race held on the Isle of Man. And the actual name of the race is the Isle of Man TT race. So, Kevin, I ask you, what does the TT stand for?
Wow. This is one of those you know it or you don't questions, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah. Because I don't think I know it. TT. Time trial? I'm going to say time trial.
Time trial.
That's the only TT I can come up with in racing. And it's either named after Thomas Twain, you know.
Tommy Time.
Yeah. Tommy Tune. Or it...
Tommy Two-Tone.
Maybe it's time trial. So that's what I'm going to say.
Kevin says time trial. Final answer.
That's it. Boom.
All right. Well, that was short and sweet.
Decided. All right. Well, I can reciprocate with a quick question.
Yeah.
You are a consumer of Pontiac-themed media, no doubt.
No doubt.
Yeah. Well, a few years back, there were magazines, and there were some magazines that were themed in the Pontiac enthusiast world. Mm-hmm. One of them changed titles a couple of times. It started off as Thunder Am magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You ever see Thunder Am?
I think I have, yeah.
Thunder Am became TA magazine.
Mm-hmm.
For 7 issues or so. What did TA Magazine become?
Well, I think I actually might know this one, Kev.
Right on.
Yeah. And I believe what was Thunder Am that became TA became High Performance Pontiac.
Wow. So either you knew that one or you deduced that there... maybe aren't that many Pontiac magazines, and that had the word Pontiac in the title.
There were not that many. There were maybe 2.
Good chance. All right. Is that your final answer?
That is my final answer.
All right. Well, it is duly noted.
Right on.
All right. Well, we will find out at the end of the show.
Dig it.
Yeah. So, I guess while we're talking about Pontiacs, we can do a real quick update on the GTO motor.
Oh, right on. Yes, sir. I was able to meet up with my buddy Randy. As we all know, that's where the engine is living right now while it's awaiting its revitalization. And we were able to get the heads painted up, get the intake painted up, and get everything. We got the heads torqued down. We got the push rods measured and got the push rods ordered. and they are in a box right behind me.
Yeah, they came already. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, they came within a week. So I think I ordered on a Friday, and they came on a Thursday, the following Thursday.
Outstanding.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. Ordered them through the shop, and your parts guy, Brian, was fantastic with the communication and made sure I knew every step of the process. And right on. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, so we got that, and I'll be going back out this weekend to get that mounted, get the rocker arms on there, get the valve covers on, get the intake mounted, the valley pan, test fit some stuff, like test fit the fuel line from the fuel pump to the carburetor, make sure it's correct. Just kind of start buttoning up little odds and ends at this point, and then pretty soon we'll be able to get the car over there and get this stinking thing in and see if it works.
That's outstanding. Look, I mean, there's a direct line to that time, that stage of the game. Your Quadrajet that you're reinstalling on this Pontiac motor, is that the original for the car? Or
no.
Correct part number or similar?
No, it's actually a 70 model carburetor, but it is for an automatic transmission, which my car is.
Okay.
Yeah, but a legit 67 Quadrajet for a GTO they're not easy to find, and when you do find them, people want a lot of money for them.
I bet.
Like $1,000, a lot of money for them.
You know, and then you still got to rebuild it.
You still got to rebuild it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is that it's not even the best carburetor for that car. The later year, mid-70s Quadrajets were a much better unit because they had a lot of design changes and little tweaks that made them more efficient and better. But still, part of you just wants that legit old-school original piece for it, even if it's not the best piece.
Well, yeah, and I don't think a lot of people realize that a Quadrajet is not just a Quadrajet. You know, they made them for so many different engine applications and for different engine sizes, and their Chevy versions and Pontiac and Buick and all the different GM brands. In fact, there's a Ford that came with the Quadrajet.
Is there?
A question there, yeah. I'm not going to say what it is now.
Well, yeah. I'll be doing a little research.
No, oh, great. And they all kind of look the same, but one of the things you got to watch out for is the direction of the fuel inlet.
Correct. Correct.
Because yours probably goes straight out the front.
Yep.
Yeah.
Chevys go to the passenger side, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the BOP stuff, Buick Olds Pontiac, goes straight forward.
Right. Right. Right.
And that's where people can get jammed up, or they buy a Quadrajet from a 1982 305 Chevy, you know, low compression, small displacement, and it doesn't move the fuel and the air that they're expecting.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because even though, you know, you might have an 800 CFM Quadrajet, you set it next to a 500 CFM and it's the same. It looks the same.
Exactly. It looks identical. Yeah. You really need to look up the number that's stamped on the side on the main body and know what you have. Yeah. This one was a GTO carb. The numbers, they tell the tale.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, it is cool. And there was my old man, when I got the car from him, he had two Quadrajets that he ran in that car, and he didn't like either one, which is why the car had an Edelbrock carb when I got it. And it was a Edelbrock 600 CFM basic Edelbrock carb. And it ran okay. It wasn't bad, but it's not really what I wanted for this. So I did rebuild it, just a basic rebuild, regasketed it, new floats, new needle and seats and all that stuff, just to make sure everything is right and, you know, make sure the float level's where it needed to be. So hopefully it runs okay. And if I need to, like, if it still has vacuum leaks, like, I know the throttle bushings The throttle shafts will leak sometimes and they'll need to be rebushed. The fuel well plugs may leak.
So those steps you did not do yet?
I did not. No, sir.
Okay. Well, you can't, take care of everything. You got to leave a few projects on the table.
That's right. I don't want this thing to be like a brand new car. All I do is drive it.
Right.
I need it to break down.
It
needs to be authentic.
A leaky bushing or throttle shaft orifice and a fuel well plug is not going to be a breakdown.
No, that's true.
It's just going to make it a little harder to start, and might not be quite as smooth because of the vacuum leak, but right. Other than that.
True. Yeah, but it's you're right. There is definitely light at the end of the tunnel on this. There's a direct path to completion, which is nice, which I haven't had in a long time.
No, that's so cool.
Yeah.
You getting nervous?
Huh?
You getting nervous?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit. I want it to run nice. I want it to sound good. I don't want any major leaks.
This is the stage of the game where I try to tell people and myself to have no expectations whatsoever.
Yeah,
it's
difficult.
Yeah, I know you put work into it and the whole thing, yeah. And you pick parts and it was all machined and built right. But I'm not saying expect it to not run.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying nothing. Just do the work, turn the key, and see what happens. Mm-hmm.
And fix what's not right.
Something's not going to be right. You're definitely going to have to do some initial tuning, your idle, your choke, and timing, right. And all that kind of jazz. And it's so great that that's a roller, so you don't have to worry about a flat tap a cam scenario.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it'll be cool.
Yeah, it will be cool. The one thing that just scares me is, Pontiacs are notorious for leaking, the rear main seal leaking, and I'm just praying I don't see like a stream of oil coming out of the back when it fires up.
Right. Well, so that's a great question. Is there a trick while the engine's out of the car to ensure a successful rear main seal?
I mean, I guess you could fill the oil pan up with oil and tilt it so it's all...
Yeah, I'm wondering if
it drips.
Is any of that seal accessible from the back of the crank?
No.
On a Pontiac? So the rear, the last main bearing completely encompasses.
Yes. You can't see it from the back. It's all. I mean, you certainly can't replace it without pulling the rear main off and and all that stuff.
I was just wondering if there was something that could be sprayed on it
to
keep it soft. Make sure that it's
well. It's I use that BOP one piece main seal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I've heard good things. So hopefully it works the way it's supposed to work, and we installed it by the way the instructions told us to. So we'll see what happens.
Is that a seal that was for a different application that's still being made that somebody figured out works in that engine?
I don't know what the history is of it.
Because I know like on when we did the S71 Oldsmobile at BTR Performance with Bill Trovato, I think there was no Viton or one-piece rear seal available for an Olds diesel block, 350. So I think he was able to source a Ford, like a 429 or a Ford 460 seal. Yeah, and that's still being made, and it works in that application. It fits.
That's cool.
Just curious to know if it's... I know you can't really go to AutoZone and say, I want a one-piece rear main for a...
Right.
A Pontiac 400.
Well, it was probably designed for that engine because it was from BOP. And they designed it and they manufactured it. I misunderstood the question initially. I apologize.
Right. Yeah.
I hope there's not a test later.
No. I'm not good with tests. Are you kidding me? Questions are bad enough.
Right.
All right. Well, that's a great update. That'll be exciting to hear. And we're all looking forward to it. So, and you mentioned you know, we're talking about the fuel system of the car, essentially, with the carburetor and, mm-hmm. and gasoline and all that stuff. And I believe it was just today, as we record this, that our friends at GM made quite an announcement.
They did, didn't they?
Yeah. And it's, they want to, everybody's probably heard this already, but they want to cease production of gasoline-powered vehicles by 2035. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And go carbon, globally carbon neutral by 2040.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, I'm a little surprised, but I'm not surprised. With the way that the electric car market has been growing, and gasoline or oil is a finite resource. Mm-hmm. Part of me thinks it makes sense. I mean, obviously we don't know exactly how much oil is left or how many more years of production there is, but knowing that it will run out someday if nothing changes, I think it's good that large manufacturers are seeking alternative power sources with renewable energy sources. Mm-hmm. So I'm not super upset by the announcement. It had to happen someday.
Mm-hmm.
And with battery technology the way it's advancing, I think range anxiety is going to be a thing of the past. You're sure a lot of people are going to miss the sound of an engine, a real, you know, throaty, you know, big cammed, you know, open exhaust kind of an engine. But there's a lot of power with an electric car.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's a lot of pluses that come with that. So.
Well, I think you've obviously touched on a bunch of things there that are elements of this. And in my opinion, I am completely fine with, you know, electric powered motivation, you know, mm-hmm. driving around with an electric car or whatever. But I oftentimes feel like I'm being sold something that has an ulterior motive.
Hmm.
And the reason why I say that is because part of the way GM is going to try and achieve that carbon neutrality is through carbon credits and other things where they don't actually have to zero out their carbon production. They can just do some political stuff and trade out, you know, this plant for one that's doing better, and then it averages out. And the whole deal is, you know, to avoid fines and you know, other stuff. Now, I am 1,000,000% in favor of a clean environment,
mm-hmm.
and preserving the natural resources of the earth, because that those are also, you know, finite as we know them.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing that kind of strikes me is it's a 14-year target. And I fully realize that if you don't set a target or a goal, you'll never get there.
Correct.
And if you set a lazy goal, we'll say, you know, maybe to use a term of realistic, if they said, yeah, you know, maybe 25 years, you know, mm-hmm. what would be, it'll probably take you 40. But if you say, I'm going to do this in 14, you know, you might hit it in 20.
Okay.
You know, it's just, it's like, you know, if you're a professional salesperson and every year they raise your quota by 150%, you got to do 150% more than last year,
mm-hmm.
you know, just because without that goal, you'll never achieve your potential. So I think there's a little bit of that. But one of the things I'm thinking is that as they start to develop this process, 14 years from now, if we think back 14 years, that's what, 2007? That's a blink of the eye, right?
Yeah.
2007 seems like yesterday. My car that I drive daily is a 2007, you know. So between 2007 and today, GM is banking on a cross-country infrastructure that's going to support charging electrical vehicles. I don't realistically see the rest of the world being as ambitious as GM and making that happen. Because we're talking apartment complexes where people live and open highway stuff. I mean, that's... So are they, you know, stepping in something soft by potentially taking themselves out of the market and out of the consideration for customers who don't have the ability to use that vehicle?
Yeah, there's that. What I also think, to that point, say they make the goal and in 14 years they're no longer selling cars that run on gas. Okay. Either be it electric or some other alternative fuel, like maybe hydrogen. They are just going to start selling those vehicles. That doesn't mean that the infrastructure has to be there nationwide. Obviously, they're going to be in more populated areas when I think people in those areas will be more apt to buy those things versus somebody who lives out in the country who doesn't have access to like a rapid charging station. So I think over time, it'll proliferate throughout the United States. And the infrastructure will grow to accommodate the growing number of electric vehicles that are undoubtedly going to be released to us.
And I get that too. You know, go to the heart of the population centers and sell to them. But the number one vehicle is a truck.
The Ford F-150?
This year, I think it is a Silverado. I think it got
what?
Beat.
Crazy talk.
It might be crazy talk, but I do remember hearing that the Ford got knocked off. And I think that's because of some of the repercussions of the aluminum body structure.
Oh, the aluminum bed and body.
Yeah. And that's a different story.
Right.
But, you know, you can't discount the smaller population centers or the ones that are farther away from the major urban centers that might not have, you know, the electrical capability to support all those chargers. So I again, these type of things make me feel like it's probably not going to happen, but I love the fact that they want to do it. You know, I think it's a really neat target. And another thing that I don't know if anybody who was reading the news today about this strategy. The other thing is, in China, electric vehicles are highly incentivized.
Is that right?
So I think that's where they're targeting to sell all this stuff.
Mm.
You know, GM already sells a ton of stuff in China, and it's a huge growing market. And, you know, if they can sell EVs there and all of a sudden they're not part of the problem, you know, they might get government help from the Chinese government.
Yeah.
And be an attractive, more competitive vehicle, you know, over there. And they already have electric vehicles in China and in, you know, Asia Pacific and all that. But it sounds like we're already starting to see the evolution of these things as they get better and better and they drive farther and farther and more stuff there.
Yeah. Also, say this does happen in 14 years, you know, the gas pumps aren't going to turn off and go away. There's still going to be quite a few cars that run on gas for a number of years, even as General Motors starts introducing nothing but electrics or nothing but carbon neutral type of cars.
For sure.
And there's still going to be a huge used market that's going to be viable for quite a few years as well.
Yes, and many people make the argument today that the EVs are, by comparison, categorically more expensive than a gasoline-powered car or a diesel vehicle.
Right.
But I don't know that argument's going to hold water in 14 years because Bernoulli's curve? Is that the one where everything gets half the size and twice the speed exponentially as technology develops?
Yes.
And the price is going to drop. You know, we are seeing batteries, like you're saying, the battery life is extending and extending and extending, and the technology is becoming more and more available. So I don't think that's a solid argument. But when you were saying it's not the same as a throaty V8 rumbling. There's people that are going to miss their four-cylinder.
That's true.
You know, that, and that's the big one. That's what most of the cars are. You know, your daily driver is a Chevy Cruze. You know, that's
yep.
And I'm not saying you're waxing poetic for that car, but people like what they like, you know?
Right.
I think in the automotive industry, especially in the aftermarket and performance industries, there's a couple things going on. A, there's tremendous opportunity.
Yes.
Because we now have a market segment that is going to, it's going to grow. And it's not, it's funny because it's not, to me, it doesn't feel demand driven. It definitely feels like it's being pushed.
Mm-hmm.
The people that seem to demand the EVs are not the ones that are driving.
Hmm.
And that's a generalization, but you have a lot of the younger crowd that is all about the environment, that they don't even ever want to own a car. They're happy with Ubering and taking public transportation and, you know, telecommuting and all that stuff. But they're the first ones to, you know, to scorn the gasoline engine. And the other side of that is getting back to the sound of the big V8 and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity is there in the aftermarket to enhance those vehicles the same way. So the biggest segment for aftermarket parts is the restyling segment.
Mm. I did not
know
that.
Yep. So you know, you'll still be able to buy
a
Chevy a Chevy Static or whatever it's going to be.
Nice. Well played, you know, sir. Well played.
You know, that might be the new version of the Nova, you know, because in Spanish, Nova means no go,
right.
and Static means doesn't move. I like that. But, you know, you'll be able
awesome.
To, you'll be able to buy a ski rack and, you know,
right.
Brush guards and you know, anything you want for those. So that opportunity exists. And then, of course, the aftermarket repair part industry. So they still need tires and they'll still need bearings and they'll still need a lot of parts. They don't need all the parts because there's far less in an electric vehicle, but they'll still need a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, smart companies right now are looking at that and saying, okay, you know, is there anything that we can do that's not terribly far off our core business to maybe reach out into that market and be present when it happens instead of, you know, or as it's happening rather than wake up one day and go, oh no, you know, we got a problem.
Well, it also begs the thought of what, as gasoline consumption decreases, what are municipalities going to do to recoup that tax base that they get from every gallon of gas?
Well, I heard something interesting about that. They're talking about a tire tax.
Really?
Yep. So, and it's an interesting concept because they're talking about levying like a big tax on tires, which sucks, you know.
Sure.
But the ones that are affected more are the ones that drive more and buy more tires, which are also the people that are putting more wear and tear on the roadway and on the infrastructure.
Sure.
So that's kind of fair as far as the way it's levied.
Mm-hmm.
It's still not necessarily fair that it's a tax, you know, but that's one of the places where they would recoup that is looking at things that are, well, you know, of course there's probably going to be, and I can't believe there isn't now, but you know, if they see an electric vehicle with a charger parked at your house, you know, you're probably going to get a tax for that.
Right. Yeah.
They'll figure out a way to recoup it. You know?
Oh, they'll get their money. About that. They're going to get their cut, baby. Rest assured.
So, but the other side of the performance industry, or in my case, the restoration business and everything else, is, you know, that immediate knee-jerk fear that you alluded to, that, you know, in a few years, I won't be able to drive my 67 GTO because there'll be no gasoline or no pumps. And I certainly don't think that's going to happen.
Same.
Just because there's, it's such a big thing. There's so much.
There's 300 million cars on the road that all use gas.
Right, so, exactly. So
it's going to take decades to go away.
I don't know if gasoline prices will rise or fall. They could fall because there's less demand, but they could rise because there's less supply. But
yeah,
in our world, I've had this conversation with people who are not car enthusiasts who say, you know, what do you do? And we tell them, you know, we restore cars at the VA, you know, Speed and Resto shop. And what do you mean you restore cars? Well, we, you know, we take gold classics and make them new again. Well, aren't those, you know, gross polluters and you know, bad for the environment? And I reached out to SEMA today, and I haven't heard back because they have a tremendous research department that has wonderful data, and they do these great reports. But I don't know how many classic cars are on the road, and I don't know how many miles those log every year. But the impact of a classic car on the environment is like nothing.
Right. Negligible. Not even a blip.
Right. From a tailpipe emission standpoint, you know, maybe a couple thousand miles a year for the people that are really active. You know, in your case, you could average out your GTO and it hasn't put any miles on the road in the past 3-4 years.
No. About five.
Yeah, I'm trying to give you a little credit there. But, so, you know, they've always had these, you know, Hot Rod magazines famous for doing their, you know, can they outlaw hot rodding and all those things. And they sell a lot of, they sold a lot of magazines, I should say, using that topic. And that was more about staying within the realm of a gasoline powered vehicle and, just making it past the more stringent emissions. But I think if the EVs take over the world, so to speak, nobody's really going to care about tailpipe emissions from petrol enthusiast cars anymore, because it's just, it's, you know, it's just insignificant by comparison. So
well, hopefully you don't get those extremists who, if they see anything emitting tailpipe emissions, they think the earth is going to die. So,
well, hopefully we don't get those extremists in power.
Yeah. Oh, no kidding.
We have those extremists are out on the street everywhere right now, you know, but, so I think there needs to be perhaps some marketing and some, some PR campaigns by the enthusiast car world, you know, because it's interesting to me. There's a lot of naysay and doomsday around performance cars and muscle cars, classic cars, antiques, all that kind of stuff. And it comes in the form of people saying, "Oh well, you know, nobody cares about those anymore, and they're all going to lose value and be worthless, and they're going to get outlawed, and you know, you won't be able to drive them and everything else." And then you look at what really happens, and the Mecham auction last weekend did $141 million.
Oh, boy.
I mean, it's crazy.
That is crazy. From one auction.
Right. From a week-long deal.
Gee whiz. That's, well, I mean, if you had any question about the popularity of the industry, that really is a good barometer.
Right. And I think we talked about it before. As long as, you know, cool cars or cars that we think are cool anyway appear in movies.
Yeah, right.
You know, every bad guy and every good guy drives some cool car. And, you know, there you go. So the enthusiasm is I think, is always going to be there. It's just the availability. And unfortunately, if the market starts to go away, the companies will, you know, find something else to make to stay in business. But today the aftermarket industry is rated at about $46 billion annually. It's huge. And the biggest segments are trucks and truck parts and, you know, truck accessories. And then it goes down to, you know, SUVs. So, you know, and the crossover SUVs, and then like, you know, four-door and two-door passenger cars, you know, late model stuff. And one of the smallest pieces of the pie, believe it or not, is the classic business. And it's only like 2%.
Really?
Of the whole aftermarket. And a lot of times, guys like you and I, we hear the word aftermarket, and you might envision, you know, like a reproduction quarter panel just pops into your head, you know, when you think aftermarket. Well, aftermarket, like I said, it also means repair parts and maintenance products, in addition to the performance aftermarket, you know, and enthusiast aftermarket. But even that little 2% is like almost $900 million a year.
Oof. Yeah. Wow.
Almost $900 million a year is spent on vehicles that aren't driven very often and are highly cared for and are, you know, revered and considered important. So if that nearly $900 million investment every year starts to dwindle, that's when I'll believe that there's a, you know, the future's not there for these cars.
Aha. Well, that's cool. I mean, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Just the old car market was 900 million. That is unbelievable. Hey, can you imagine in like 50 years or so, people go to like a car meet and someone says, "Hey, look at that old classic Tesla. Oh my gosh, isn't that something? How'd you get a battery for that? That thing didn't even have autopilot. You believe that?"
Yeah, you're right. And I think the Tesla's a perfect example. I think that would actually happen.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't think people are going to go, "Oh, check out that Hyundai Sonata."
Yeah.
You know, I think certain cars are just doomed to be appliances forever.
True.
But Teslas they're already enthusiast cars, you know. Mm-hmm. People are fanatical about them, and they've got their following. So, but I also think 50 years from now, you're still going to have a 67 GTO in the parking lot at a cruise night. And
I sure hope so.
A 70 Chevelle and 86 Riv. Mustang. And I don't know, you're not going to find many 70 Rivs.
They'll be well-preserved.
Yeah, I mean, because the 32 Ford, how old is that? You still see those things out at shows, and
You know what? You're right. Yeah.
So, you know, the popularity kind of comes and goes, and we've talked about the kind of the rise and fall and changing popularity of street rides from the 30s and 40s, and you know, that are doing their cycle of popularity, and I think are coming back these days because younger people are putting new spins on you know, some of these cars, and it just keeps cycling, you know. If they don't make any new 67 GTOs, but they're still coming out with new parts for them.
Yeah, crazy, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So I think there's a lot to consider about this EV concept and General Motors. I don't know if it's a good decision for them or not. I think it's admirable.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that they are looking to the future. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say there's a need on the environmental side. I'm not the world's biggest, you know, tree hugger, green environment fanatic. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you what, I sure do love camping and spending time in nature and breathing clean air, you know.
And I would like future generations to enjoy that as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, you can make the argument that every time I start my 70 Riv, something's happening to the environment.
You know, yeah.
The choke's on and it's running rich and you can smell the unburnt hydrocarbons coming out the tailpipe. But I also know that, you know, the earth has a way of managing that kind of stuff on its own.
It does. Yes. With more cars that do go electric, you starting up that 70 Riv or me starting up this GTO will have absolutely zero effect on the environment, especially long term. Because, like you said, the earth does have a way to take care of that kind of thing through it's the magic of Mother Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm not too worried about that.
And the other component of that GM decision is that they're talking about making their whole company carbon neutral by 2040. So all of their manufacturing plants,
Right.
They want to run on renewable energy.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. Is that possible? You know, I don't know if they can retrofit existing plants or are they building new? And then they said they want their suppliers to follow suit.
You're right.
And they're going to buy, you know, only from qualifying renewable energy suppliers. So now, you know, the companies that make alternators and batteries and all that stuff, they got to comply or kind of get pushed out of business.
Yeah.
Or find another market, you know, or whatever. And that's why I say this feels like it's being kind of thrust on the marketplace instead of natural demand.
But that said, if somebody doesn't carry the torch on it, then nothing will happen. We'll just keep burning gas, keep dealing with the after effects, keep dealing with oil spills, whatever environmental effects that has, until you eventually run out of oil, or it just becomes too expensive to do anything with. Because we don't recycle oil. We can't recycle gasoline.
Right.
So once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah, I do think it's a giant step to move the needle.
Yeah.
And you know, get the ball rolling, because it's my opinion that or my perception anyway, that there's all kinds of companies that are working on stuff to you know, have better efficiency and electric vehicles, mm-hmm. and zero emission stuff. But there's, like you're saying, there's no real deadline. They're just, we developed this now, and
yeah,
next year maybe we'll develop that. And now GM is like, no, it's on.
Mm-hmm. It's go time.
Yes. So that's mm-hmm. a heck of a motivator. So I think that matches the state of California's mandate, right, of outlawing those cars too? Is that what it was? By 2035, outlawing the sale of...
I didn't read that part of it, unfortunately.
I think it was California outlawed the sale of new petroleum-powered vehicles by 2035.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and I really like GM's voluntary position over a law.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no doubt.
You know, when somebody says you can't do that, then you want to do it more.
Yeah, exactly. I'm gonna let my car idle all night in California now. How about that?
Yeah, right. So it is interesting.
Yeah, it is. It makes you wonder how, you know, these electric cars are going to age, how difficult or expensive batteries are going to be, and how often they'll have to be replaced. How much longer it's viable to do that. You know, when does the cost versus, you know, benefit exceed viability, things like that.
I'll go even further, and I'm going to suggest that we're going to see legislation that says you cannot renew an electric vehicle that's more than, say, 10 years old or whatever, because the new battery technology is going to be a million times more efficient than the old.
Hmm.
And it's bad for the environment to make batteries anyway to start with. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is some sort of a law with a lifespan on these things.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. That's kind of spooky. I don't know where that thought came from.
I mean, I would hope there'd be, I would hope there would be some kind of law that mandates recycling of the old batteries, not just throwing them in a landfill.
Yeah, that's a horrible thing, because batteries certainly can be recycled.
Yeah, totally.
And they should be, because that's a finite resource too. So when you see hear those stories about how they mine the earth for this materials, you know, if you could get them out of recycling, it's not the same, but I mean, it gets you halfway down
it's
the road
better,
anyway.
Yeah.
But as far as the way the cars hold up, I have not had a lot of experience up close and personal with Teslas, and you know, to be able to examine the suspension and the build quality and the type of materials they use. I know it's mostly plastic and aluminum, and I don't know how well plastic and aluminum hold up over, you know, decades and decades. Are we going to have your 50-year question? You know,
right.
It would have to be a garage-kept, very nice Tesla to be around in 50 years.
Tesla, yeah.
So that the sun didn't completely dry out the plastic and it all crack and...
Right, yeah. And keep it waxed nicely and keep it, you know, keep it out of the sun.
And yeah, and in some ways, I kind of equate the Teslas to the... to a lot of these Cadillacs that you see from the 60s and 70s and 80s that have like no miles on them and they're perfectly, they're like new and
yeah.
they keep showing up, you know. I'm in some different Facebook groups, you know, of Cadillacs and land barges and you know,
<You're right.
laughs> giant American cars and all that stuff. And every, you know, it seems like a couple times a week, somebody pulls out a 73 Sedan DeVille that's got, you know, 18,000 miles on it. It's like new. Well, the reason for that is when those cars were purchased, they weren't the utility car. They were a Cadillac, you know,
yeah.
an expensive one. So they were taken care of. They were dealer serviced most of the time. They're stored in a garage and they were, you know, maybe that purchaser's last vehicle, you know, might have been, you know, an elderly person or somebody who took care of it because they liked it. And it was also expensive. And I think that's what we're seeing with a lot of Teslas right now is people like them and they're expensive. So they're being maintained. I haven't seen, you know, Teslas with bumper covers falling off and duct tape on the windows. And, you know,
true.
You just don't see that, right?
I don't think I have either.
but I think maybe there'll be the, you know, 3 years into production, there'll be Chevy Statics with, you know, stuff falling off them.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Because of the neglect, you know, that's just a, it's just transportation. You know?
Dripping battery acid instead of oil.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That'd be awesome.
That'd be real great for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, geez. But it you know, makes you think of the limited use of some of the cars that we play with and the possibility of driving an old car as a daily.
Mm.
And, you know, what does that take? And is it even possible?
Yeah. Well, it definitely takes some doing, I think, because as we know, these older cars require a bit more hands-on maintenance than your Chevy Static would or your Chevy Cruze does. You know, it being them being carbureted, different environmental conditions are going to affect your air fuel ratio, whereas your, you know, your new car can adjust for that. And just the basic maintenance as well. It takes quite a bit more. Mm-hmm. There's actually a guy out in, I think he's in Flagstaff. Name is Steve Barsack, who is a big Pontiac guy. He still daily drives a 71 GTO.
Nice.
All the time. That's all he, that's he only
car.
Has old cars. He doesn't have anything new.
Yeah.
And he maintains it and he drives it and he loves it. And he's like, and he advocates for people doing that.
Well, there's, and again, we've said this in the past, there's less of an environmental impact of even if he daily drives that thing, because the impact on the earth when the car was manufactured has been amortized 30 years ago,
right.
You know, so it's only environmental impact is tailpipe emissions at this point.
Correct.
And when you fire up the GM Chevrolet static plant and start kicking those things out,
yeah.
you've got the impact there. So I think if I didn't care as much about the car, I could drive my 70 RIV every day.
Cool.
I don't think there'd be a problem with it, but I just don't want to get it. I don't want it to rust and
get a lot of road grime on it and
yes,
get beat up. Yeah, I understand. I mean, I would love to drive this GTO every day. Back when I was in the Air Force, my daily driver was my 66 Sprint 6 Le Mans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, it was at that point, and this was in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when these cars were not necessarily sought after high-valued classics, but were still an older used car that was could be either fairly worn out or clapped out, but you still had to do what you had to do to make it run and drive. And yeah, maybe it was rusty. You know, some of the paint was mismatched. Maybe it was dented. Things that you would never allow to happen these days with that same vehicle.
Yeah.
And if it got even a little too rusty, you would consider junking it. Where you'd have to be so far gone these days for you to junk anything like that.
Oh, yeah. And you still see that out west in the dry states. You know, every once in a while, you'll see a gem driving around. I remember being in California a couple years ago, and there's some dude's driving a 70 Trans Am, and it's just an old car.
That's killer.
You know, paint's all faded, and it had door dings everywhere, mm-hmm. and it was kind of leaning to the, you know, a little bit. And,
yeah.
But that's what it was, and he's still motoring along. I think if you can keep the thing in tune is the one thing, and if you can put up with some of the idiosyncrasies. I remember my first 70 Riv was my daily driver, and that car had air conditioning and power windows and, you know, a bunch of options. Mm-hmm. But in nights that were very cold and like snowing or raining hard, you'd come to a stoplight and you got your wipers on, you got your heater on, mm-hmm. you know, or your air conditioner on, and you got the headlights on and the radio's on, and the headlights or the windshield wipers start slowing down, you know,
oh boy.
And the headlights get dimmer and dimmer, and you know, the electrical system just can't keep up with all that stuff because it's old wiring and, sure. you know, a wiped out voltage regulator and a tired alternator and all that stuff. And we so take that for granted today with modern cars. The electronics in them are just so much more robust.
A lot of the parts are so much more robust.
Yeah. I mean, you never see, you know, a car with dim headlights today.
No, you really don't.
No.
No. You're absolutely right. I mean, I'll tell you what. This Chevy Cruze I've had since 2013, I've put 170,000 miles on it, and I replaced an alternator on it, and a water pump and some various cooling system parts. That's about it. And it has just been, you know, knock on wood, rock steady.
Yeah.
And it's amazing the quality that was built into that car mm-hmm. for an Econo box and how long it's lasted.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, even things like the seats don't wear out quite as much.
Right.
You know, and I think there's kind of a bell curve. The cars from the 60s and early 70s, you didn't see. The seat frames were solid steel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the upholstery would wear out and they would sink in the padding. But it wasn't like the seat back was all bent, you know, and reclined. I think in the mid-70s and early 80s, they started to try to make cars lighter any way they could. Mm-hmm. And that's when you saw the second generation Trans Ams are so famous for the driver's seat leaning to the right side.
Yep.
You know, and it's because that seat back is just not very strong because uh-huh. they try to make them lighter. And I remember reading when, I think it was when the Lexus first came out, that they were bragging about how light some of the internal components were in an article, and there was some kind of factor, like the seat had to withstand six times its, you know, capacity weight in an impact, right?
Okay.
So if the seat weighed, you know, 100 pounds, you know, it had to withstand a 600 pound impact or some kind of thing. It was some kind of safety factor of mm-hmm. 6 or 8 or something. But people were concerned about the safety of the seats because the factor was the same, but they made the seat lighter and lighter and lighter.
Oh.
Yeah. So the frame got lighter and everything else. So now less weight or less of an impact would destroy it.
Yeah. If a 100-pound seat became a 20-pound seat, that same 600 pounds is going to crumple you up.
Right. It's gone. Yeah. So, but I, you know, you notice today you don't really see, I mean, the interior in your Cruze is probably still pretty nice. You know,
it's very nice. There's no tears. There's no rips. The dash isn't cracked. Everything is great.
And again, these are things that a cracked dash on a car built in the last 20 years, have you ever seen one? You know, I don't know.
Not really.
It's nuts, but you know, every muscle car, the dash looks like a potato chip. It's all twisted up and it's got cracks in it and it's bent. And And I know it's just the manual. And those actually had a steel insert in them, and then the foam, and then the
right,
the vacuum formed vinyl or whatever the heck was over.
Yeah, so, definitely higher quality materials used today. Better manufacturing techniques, better designs.
Yeah, and then there's the whole safety argument of if you get in a wreck with something that only has a lap belt and no crumple zones and no bags and all that, and quite honestly, maybe it's me getting older. There are times when that enters my mind.
Well, sure.
Especially driving our convertible, driving the 62 Ford around.
Yeah.
Thinking that if we get hit or I hit somebody or getting in some kind of impact with that thing, we're toast.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how much more things hurt as you get older.
Well, especially when it's a non-collapsing steering column that's going through your sternum,
There's that.
Yeah.
There's that.
Yeah. Somebody pointed out to us a few years ago, we're talking about GM A-bodies, I think it was a Cutlass, like a 71 or something. Mm-hmm. And we're discussing the safety of the hood latch and some of the things. And the guy's like, I don't care. If I hit somebody, that hood's going to come straight through the windshield and cut me in half.
Boy. Oh, man.
Maybe that's true. I don't know.
Ooh, I hope not.
No, absolutely. You don't want that to happen to anybody. But those accidents back in those days were horrific.
Yeah. Crash safety was definitely in its infancy back then.
Yeah, so.
If that.
But old cars are so cool to drive.
Cool to drive.
It's the stuff you put up with, and you just be careful and, live your life. You can't be freaked out and scared of it the whole
time. Also, the less you drive it, obviously, the less chance of you getting in that accident. So
sure, but if you're going to consider one as a daily.
As a daily, then you got to be a little more, watchful with things.
Right.
And make sure that everything is tip-top in tune, especially your brakes and your tires, your suspension components. So those things tend to wear out, a lot quicker than on a modern car as well. So
sure, yeah. When you
need to make sure your chassis is solid.
Your 1958 Chevrolet you're driving around every day weighs, double what your Chevy Cruze does, so it eats rubber parts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, that the concept of, I got to be careful is one thing. And like you're suggesting, you just got to know a good mechanic or you got to be able to do all this stuff yourself.
Mm-hmm. You're going to have more, if you daily your classic, you're going to have more service done to it than your new car.
So what if we turn the tables and say, what would be the ideal, not necessarily top enthusiast classic car to drive, but if you wanted to get off the grid and you wanted to go full analog and no computers, but you wanted an older car to drive every day, say what's your commute? How many miles each way?
15 miles each way.
15. So you're doing like a 30-35 mile round trip. So you're probably pretty average, maybe 20. I don't know what the average is these days, but you just want something to drive to work and back that has no technology on board. What would it be?
Oh, man. I could think of 100 cars I'd love to do that with. Maybe a Firebird to do that in. Maybe like a first-gen Firebird, I think would be cool.
Yeah. So, again, you're thinking more on the enthusiast side than...
Mm-hmm. And if it was just a...
appliance commuter.
Like a grocery getter. Maybe a Falcon or a Chevy 2 or something.
Yeah, so I think early 60s would be a cool way to go.
Mm-hmm.
A Ford Falcon is a great example, even like a Ranchero.
Yeah.
Falcon Ranchero, because those cars are very light.
Yeah.
And they're efficient.
They are.
And, you get a straight six in that thing with a single throw carburetor on it, and you're going to get some decent mileage.
You are.
I was thinking more along the lines of like a 1980 Toyota.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Like a Tercel or, you know, a Corolla. If you recall, they were advertising 35 to 40 miles per gallon on carburetors in the early 1980s.
That's crazy.
They got some huge fuel economy.
Talking about that, a guy I was in the Air Force with had a Chevy Sprint. I don't know if you remember those little tiny three-cylinder car. He got 50 miles per gallon on the highway with that thing.
Well, that was essentially very similar to the Geo Metro.
Right.
And the Suzuki. Like it was a Suzuki car, I think, right? Because Chevy was in bed with Suzuki on the Samurai.
Yes. Yes.
Which was
the
Geo Tracker.
Geo Tracker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it was the cylinder head design, and it was just the car was so light, and they were small enough, you know, that they just knocked down killer fuel economy.
Yeah.
And they had nothing on them for technology, you know, so and they went forever, you know, you could maintain them. They drive forever.
Yeah. That's a good call. Yeah. I wasn't even thinking of that.
An American car company sure know that they went forever because there was a huge bite out of sales.
yes,
damn
did.
Toyota.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Took him by surprise.
Oh,
well,
man.
We shall see about the, we got to wait 14 years and then we'll know if we're on the right track or not.
We're going to put this episode in the time capsule and unearth it in 14 years.
Yeah, right on. All right. Well, on that note, our listener has been waiting what he feels like has been 14 years for the answer to our trivia question.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Listener.
As we ramble on in several different directions.
No kidding. All right. So getting to the trivia. All right, Kevin, I asked you about the Isle of Man TT race and what the TT stands for.
Mm-hmm.
And you said time trial. A great guess, albeit not a correct one.
Ah, of course.
The TT stands for Tourist Trophy.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, the race, and I had a little blurb here, the race was originally intended for motorcycles similar to those sold to the public called touring machines.
Okay.
And soon became known as the Tourist Trophy.
Ah, so the Tourist was the type of bike.
Yeah.
Essentially, yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Well, no. We are all the wiser for that now.
Yeah, totally. All right, so my question to you was, there was some Pontiac enthusiast media back in the day, a magazine called Thunder Ram, which evolved into TA Magazine, and what did TA Magazine become? And your guess was High Performance Pontiac Magazine, and that is correct.
Yes! Yes! My first win of 2021, everybody.
Right on. The score is starting to even out already.
Yeah, nice, nice. I needed that win. I needed it.
Yeah.
Thank you for the softball. I appreciate that.
Well, it was a softball to you. I was actually unaware that TA became, or Thunder became TA, which became High Performance Pontiac.
Oh, yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they talked about that in some of the articles about the history, how it was Thunder Am in the beginning and all that good stuff. So.
I know the editor of Thunder Am and TA.
Oh, yeah?
Martin Shore, yeah.
Oh, cool.
But I did not know that they evolved those titles that way. So it was an interesting question, too.
Yeah. Yeah, great question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Winner.
Hey, winner. It feels good.
That's
I feel
it.
A little taller now.
Yeah, you look like it. You sound like it.
Right.
You sounded much taller on the radio.
I am Sheriff Branford. Oh, he sounded taller on the radio.
Very nice. All right. Well, on that note, we should probably quit while we're ahead.
Yeah, right.
We thank everybody for listening to V8 Radio and the V8 Radio podcast. This is available wherever you do listen to podcasts. If you're hearing this for the first time and you actually liked it, feel free to subscribe. Give us a review. We appreciate that. And share it with your friends. We've got a lot of cool things coming up on future episodes, not just the triumphant return of Mike's GTO, but some other interesting and fun topics and cool stuff to chat about. So we welcome everybody and invite you back to listen once again. And you have anything else to throw in before we sign them off?
I don't know what could be bigger than my GTO getting on the road, but I can't wait to find out.
There you go. I didn't say it was bigger. I just said it was in conjunction.
Right on.
All right. Well, for Mr. Mike Hubal Clark, I'm Kevin Oste. Thanks for listening to V8 Radio, and try to keep the shiny side over 100 this time.
Ooh, nice.